Okay, well, first I'd like to thank the organizers for such a wonderful conference. And then I'd like to thank Freddie for giving such a beautiful talk, making my life quite a bit easier. So I'll be discussing loop amplitudes and twister space. The recent work was done with Benna, Del Duca, Dixon, Kossauer, and Roybon in various linear combinations. These are the papers that I'll be discussing. So the outline of the talk is, first I want to say a little bit about the motivation, a little bit more about QCD and applications to collider physics, especially the LHC, which is just on the horizon. And then also about this idea of trying to solve maximally supersymmetric Yang-Mills theory. So I'll say a little bit about the CSW rules, which were, of course, very nicely discussed by Freddie. And then just a little bit about a reorganization of these rules to make them more efficient, to reduce an exponential growth down to a polynomial growth in computation. And then the issues with loops. I'll say just a little bit about what the problem with QCD is in my talk. So a crucial step is to apply these wonderful twister space ideas to QCD, but there's a technical obstruction which I'll explain. But I believe that there will be a solution to this problem. Then I'll go on to the n equals 4 super Yang-Mills amplitudes. I'll discuss this unitarity method. I'll say a little bit about the powerful new twister space ideas that Freddie discussed. And then I'll explain the twister space structure of these one loop amplitudes, and then make comments about the higher loops, and I'll show you what the conjecture is about the structure of the higher loop amplitudes. As Freddie mentioned, the higher loop amplitudes don't seem to be more complicated in terms of their analytic structure than the one loop ones, although obtaining results for higher loops is much, much more complicated. And then I'll say a little bit about what the important remaining issues are before I summarize. So first of all, collider physics. So the issue of perturbation theory is really central to questions in particle physics. In fact, an entire month of the 2004 KITP Collider Physics Workshop was devoted to the issue of pushing QCD cross-section calculations to higher order at one loop and at two loops. And the LHC is an enormous experiment in terms of the financial resources that are being poured into this. This is the CMS detector. It costs about $500 million just for this one detector. But of course, there's a reason why such enormous resources are being poured into this, these experiments. And the reason is, of course, because there's enormous physics that will come from this. There's no question that there will be a breakthrough in our understanding of TEV scale physics, and it will come from these experiments. And as theorists, it's our obligation to support these experiments as much as possible, including figuring out better ways to do these required QCD calculations for interpreting the experimental data. And that's one of the key motivations why we're interested in finding new techniques such as these twister space techniques. So now, switching gears, the n equals 4 super Yang-Mills theory. That theory by itself provides plenty of motivation for looking at twister space and looking at the scattering amplitudes in this theory. This theory will be discussed in other talks. It's already been discussed. There'll be talks on Thursday from Bizard and Staudacher on the n equals 4 theory. And the basic motivation here is very simple. In 1974, Tuft suggested that we can solve QCD in the planar limit. Well, it's already 30 years. We have not solved QCD. So, of course, if you can't solve a problem, what you do is you find another problem to solve. In fact, you find a simpler problem to solve. And n equals 4 super Yang-Mills theory is, in fact, the simplest theory, the simplest non-trivial gauge theory that you could pick, a d equals 4 gauge theory. And it's a cousin of QCD. It differs from QCD only in its matter content. In terms of the Lagrangian, instead of having quarks, you now replace it with four real fermions, six scalars. It's a conformal field theory, and of course we've had many talks about this, and it's in the ADS-CFT correspondence. But one thing that the Maldacena conjecture suggests is that this theory should really have a magical simplicity, especially in the planar limit, because it's dual to a weakly coupled theory. We're going to be talking about the scattering, amplitudes, the scattering amplitudes of this theory. And yes, I know there are no textbook scattering amplitudes, but that's not important. You can define these in standard ways, that the scattering amplitudes in completely standard ways, as we do in QCD, even though there is no S matrix of quarks and gluons in QCD either. It's not an important issue. Okay, but this question of can we solve the theory, here we're going to be, the goal, the dream is to solve the entire S matrix, to write down the entire S matrix. And of course, this is not just a question in the string theory community. As I said, this theory is a cousin of QCD. Just one more thing about the connection of two branches of discussion about N equals 4 super Yang Mills. There's been quite a lot of work on the anomalous dimensions of the N equals 4 theory. And then I'll be discussing scattering amplitudes as Cacciazzo and Cose will be discussing, or have discussed and will be discussing. So the question is, can we relate these two branches? And the answer is yes, there is a relationship, a very clear and definite relationship, although no one has carried this out really very explicitly, but the relationship is very straightforward. If you look at the splitting amplitude, you take a amplitude in the N equals 4 theory, you look at the behavior as particles become collinear, that gives you a splitting amplitude. That splitting amplitude is, roughly speaking, a square root of an Altarelli-Parisi splitting function. An Altarelli-Parisi splitting function can also be reinterpreted in terms of anomalous dimensions of leading twist operators. And this is, in fact, very well known in QCD. There are two approaches to the Altarelli-Parisi evolution. You can think about it in terms of the splitting functions, or you could think about it, as Gross, Wilczek, Georgi, and Politzer have done, in terms of computing the anomalous dimensions of the leading twist operators. In fact, in the N equals 4 theory, these anomalous dimensions have been determined to three-loop order using the very impressive and complicated calculation in QCD of Mach, Vermazren, and Voigt. So lay out some notation. So Freddie, of course, discussed this. So these are the vector polarization vectors written in terms of spinner inner products. You can think of this as simply circular polarization in a very beautiful and elegant formalism, which is sometimes referred to as Chinese magic, in honor of Zhu Zhang and Chang, who had the most, you could say, the cleanest formalism, although quite a number of people have worked on this subject. And these polarization vectors, defined in terms of these Weyl spinners, they satisfy everything a polarization vector is supposed to satisfy, so they're clearly good polarization vectors, but they give you a very powerful way to do helicity in terms of covariant objects, in terms of Lorentz covariant objects. The notation that I'll be using is the standard one from QCD, just these angle brackets and then the conjugate spinners in terms of these square brackets. This is the notation that Witten used in his paper, written out explicitly in terms of spinners. This is actually quite useful, this notation, when you're trying to figure out the properties of twister space, because we'll be taking derivatives with respect to these spinners. And when you see one of these angle brackets, you can think of it as a square root of a Lorentz inner product times some kind of phase. So in his very beautiful paper, Witten introduced idea is that twister space can really teach us a lot about the structure of the gauge theory amplitudes. And there's a precursor from Nyerere where some of the initial ideas were worked out. So at tree level, the difference between n equals 4 super Yang mills and QCD is very trivial, even with quarks. Even if you're talking about quarks or gluinos, the difference between those are just a question of the color. And the color, in fact, in all these discussions, as Freddie already said, it's all stripped away. So color is actually not so important. So if you can understand the n equals 4 theory, then you've basically solved the QCD problem. And a key observation of Witten was that after this Fourier transform, it's this funny Fourier transform that you Fourier transform with respect to one of the spinners, but not with respect to the other, to give you this twister space. The observation was that the amplitudes are supported on non-trivial curves in twister space, and then even further, he went on to do this link to the topological string theory. And this kind of duality, this description in terms of, this is a description in terms of a Lagrangian of QCD. On the other side, we have a topological string theory. It's an example of a duality, two completely different descriptions of the same physics, but unlike the Maldacena duality, this is a weak-weak duality. It's between weakly coupled and weakly coupled. So as Freddie already described in their very beautiful work, they realized the implications of the twister space structure were that there needed to be a set of vertices for building up these non-MHV. So by non-MHV, I mean more minus helicities. MHV, I mean just the two minus helicities. In terms of these Park-Taylor amplitudes. So the idea is you take this Park-Taylor amplitude, define a off-shell continuation, which has some reminiscence to light cone gauge, although it certainly is not precisely light cone gauge. The way things are arranged are a little bit different, but there's clearly some relationship to light cone gauge. And then you can very effectively generate these higher these amplitudes with more minus helicity legs by sewing together these MHV vertices. And this is actually quite amazing because we treat these vertices as if though they were local Feynman vertices, even though they are completely non-local objects. And even more amazingly is the fact that you can use them inside loops. If you try writing down non-local vertices and you try doing loops, in general you'll get chaos. So just a couple words about applications to QCD phenomenology. So the driving force in trying to find better techniques is efficiency. Feynman diagrams are extremely inefficient if you're talking about large numbers of particles as we see at the Tevatron, or we will see at the LHC. Nine jet events have already been seen at the Tevatron. 10 will surely be found. Just for amusement, with Feynman diagrams, here's a count of the number of Feynman diagrams for a 10-jet event. So that would be glue into 10 gluons, and you find 5 billion diagrams. That's a lot of diagrams. Okay, clearly, this is not the way to do things. But in fact, there are very efficient techniques that have been worked out about a decade ago, efficient techniques based on recursive ideas and other types of ideas having to do with classical field equations. And these efficient methods, what they do is they take the problem, this factorial growth of the Feynman diagrams, and they reduce it to polynomial growth. And as you know, there's a heck of a difference between a factorial and a polynomial. Now, when you look at the CSW diagrams, what you find is that they actually exhibit an exponential growth in the complexity as the number of negative legs increases. And I drew here, these we called skeleton diagrams, CSW, they called them quivers, but it's the same thing. But anyway, these skeleton diagrams for describing the CSW diagram. So that's CSW diagrams where you throw away all the external legs and it captures the basic structure of the diagrams. And you could see there's a growth in complexity, and that has to do with this exponential growth. So the question is, can you reduce it to polynomial growth? It would actually be extremely surprising if you could not do this, because as I said, you could already do this with Feynman diagrams using these recursive methods, so clearly there must be a way of doing it here. And in fact, it's not very hard to do. It's just a very, in a sense, a minor rearrangement of things. The rearrangement is you now generalize the notion of the MHV vertices to non-MHV vertices. You define it in a recursive way, and then when you do your counting, you'll find that, in fact, there's only polynomial growth. I believe it grows like m to the fourth. The number of negative, m is the number of negative helicity legs. Very amusingly, there's a very interesting twister space interpretation of these non-MHV diagrams in terms of higher degree curves in twister space. So this would be a 6 minus helicity, even though it says 5. Even though it says 5 there, it's 6 minus helicity in terms of vertices with lower helicities. So that's represented by these intersections of lower degree curves. And the points in twister space are supported on these lines, which is actually quite cute, and it's related to this work of Gukov and collaborators. So let's talk now about, let's move on to loop amplitudes. So I want to make a summary of our early papers on the subject. So the key theorem, so this is the most important theorem in our work, which guides everything we do, which is that any amplitude in any massless theory is fully determined from d-dimensional tree amplitudes, and I mean gauge invariant on-shell tree amplitudes, to all loop orders. Off-shell formulations are unnecessary. You can do everything in an on-shell way using only gauge invariant objects to build new loop amplitudes, and this is true to any loop order. All you need is unitarity, d-dimensional unitarity. But there's a corollary to this, which is the four-dimensional cut constructibility. So at one loop, what you can show is that in any massless supersymmetric gauge theory, it's actually any theory that satisfies certain power counting constraints, it's fully constructible from four-dimensional tree amplitudes. And this is very important because it means that we can use helicity. Just go right ahead inside the loops, use helicity. Make believe that you're in four dimensions. And then at the very last step, after you've done all your calculations, you just do a very trivial analytic continuation in the loop integral to deal with the infrared and ultraviolet singularities. Okay. In a theory like QCD, it does not satisfy four-dimensional cut constructibility. That's the basic technical glitch that you encounter when you try to go apply, let's say, twister techniques, which are based on four-dimensional helicity to QCD, you run into this problem. The other key ingredient in all these calculations at one loop is that we have a complete control over the basis of functions. It's just a question of figuring out coefficients of certain integrals. This knowledge is extremely powerful, okay, because it means you don't have to actually do integrals because they've already been done for you.
Question.
Yeah.
So is there a similar basis for line
loops? Case by case there is. So there are algorithms for constructing what are known as master integrals. But there's no general formulation in one fell swoop. However, there is such a basis, it's just that it is not understood. That's a way of saying it. Certainly, case by case, one can find the basis algorithmically using an algorithm known as the Laporta algorithm. But probably the most important result is the simplicity. These one-loop amplitudes, these MHV amplitudes that we computed, are much, much simpler than they ought to be. They're much, much simpler than any single diagram that you could pick. And finally, there's an explanation of this. Clearly, the explanation lies in twister space and in topological string theory. One of the tools that we use for doing these calculations, so I'll be showing you a two-loop calculation, is this notion of generalized cuts. So these are unitarity cuts. By unitarity cut, I mean that you're building the higher loop amplitudes, for example, a two-loop amplitude, by looking at on-shell. This cut means that all legs are on-shell on that cut. So you're looking at on-shell cuts here. It's on-shell here, or this three-particle cut, it's on-shell. The reason why that's so important is because now you're dealing with gauge-invariant objects. Feynman diagrams are full of gauge artifacts. Every time you touch a Feynman diagram, it is not a gauge-invariant object, and it's full of junk which cancels against other Feynman diagrams. Here we are dealing with gauge-invariant objects. If you can work in four dimensions, then you have extreme power because you can now use helicity methods. And there's this notion of these generalized cuts. So instead of building the two-loop amplitude by looking at one-loop amplitudes times trees, there's a much better way of doing things, which is to reduce the two-loop amplitude to products of three trees. Okay. And we call these things generalized cuts. And no, this does not mean the imaginary part of an imaginary part. What it means is that had we done the Feynman diagram calculation, then these propagators would not have canceled. Okay. So here's the standard optical theorem. It's the relationship of a loop amplitude, the imaginary part of a loop amplitude, to a phase space integral, Lorentz invariant phase space over here there's tree amplitudes. And the reason why this is so important in doing these calculations is that whenever you have a property of tree-level amplitudes, you can use this to induce and learn about properties at loop level. So, for example, supersymmetry. If you understand the supersymmetry Ward identities, precisely how they work at tree level, that immediately tells you what's going on at loop level and how to do the cancellations at loop level. Or any kinds of properties. For example, as Freddie discussed, we know properties of twister space of these tree amplitudes. If we know the properties in twister space of the tree amplitudes, we can then learn about the properties in twister space of the loop amplitudes very directly, because the basic idea is you can build the loops out of the trees. So just to show you how the basic idea of how this technique works, let's look at how you would do arbitrary numbers of legs at one loop. It turns out, in this case of maximal helicity violation, it turns out that such a calculation is actually very straightforward, especially as such calculations go. The basic idea is you take the loop amplitude, look at the cut, so now you have products of tree amplitudes. The tree amplitudes are very simple. They're given in terms of these Park-Taylor amplitudes. Then you observe that the Park-Taylor amplitudes have a very magical property which you can exploit, and that's that the loop momentum, this L1 and this L2, only appears in three denominators. In fact, this one you can get rid of by momentum conservation, so it only appears in two denominators. So what you do is you shake this up a little bit, convert this back to Feynman propagators by rationalizing it. So you get two propagators here. From the other side of the cut, you get another two propagators, because that's another MHV amplitude. And then you have the two cut propagators. So immediately, you're down to a hexagon integral. And you're talking about arbitrary number of legs in one fell swoop. OK, now a hexagon may sound a little bit nasty, but there are methods for dealing with this. In fact, there's even ways now, if you understand the structure of the amplitudes, that you don't even have to do a single integral. You just shake it algebraically and reduce it down to the basis of boxes, because we know what the target has to look like. It's a basis of boxes. And you can use that information to tell you how to algebraically simplify it. So just some examples of what we obtained by using the unitarity sewing method. All MHV amplitudes in the n equals 4 theory, so these are the one loop amplitudes, the amplitudes in n equals 1 super Yang mills. N equals 1 super Yang mills is very interesting because it's one step closer to QCD than the n equals 4 theory. And then we had also worked out the 6-point amplitudes, all of the 6-point amplitudes using this technique. And then there were some integrals that needed to be done. But anyway, those were done with integral reduction techniques. Just an example of what one of these things looks like. This is a 5-point amplitude. This, if I were to show you the 5-point amplitude of QCD, I would need an extremely small font to show, to fit it on a transparency. In the case of the n equals 4 theory, this is a very simple and beautiful formula, just written in terms of logarithms. In general, for higher points, you find polylogarithms. And the lesson from these calculations is that the amplitudes are much simpler than they should be, than one would expect. So now let me say a little bit about twister space. A very beautiful paper by Brandhuber, Spence, and Travaglini, which really clarified a lot about twister space, cleared away a lot of the confusion we were having in trying to understand how one could do loop level calculations using twister space ideas. So what they found is very beautiful. You take the MHV diagrams, you take the CSW rules, and you just compute. It turns out that the computation is a little tricky, but they found a path that actually made the computation quite simply, and that was to find a mapping of these CSW diagrams into the unitarity cuts. It turns out that the organization of these CSW diagrams is quite different from the way cuts are organized, but you can still find a mapping. Pieces get splattered around in non-trivial ways, but you can identify where all the pieces are, and then you can do a mapping into the unitarity cuts using this very beautiful formula. So there's the integral in the CSW rules. One would expect that you have to integrate over the loop momentum. There's an integral over loop momentum. This is an off-shell loop momentum. And what they were able to do is find a representation of this integral in terms of on-shell quantities. And once you do that, then you're talking about unitarity cuts. So it's on-shell. There's an on-shell phase space integral times a dispersion integral. And they were able to assign proper I epsilons in order to reproduce the old results for the MHV calculation for arbitrary numbers of legs. And in fact, it's not just n equals 4. There's clearly nothing special about n equals 4. This was proven or demonstrated, I should say, not proven because it's only for special cases, in the n equals 1 theory. So the n equals 1 super Yang mills theory is another example of one of these cut constructible theories where we're allowed to work in 4 dimensions and then just at the end do an analytic continuation to d dimensions and you still get the right answer. And they demonstrated that you get, in fact, the correct answer. Two recent papers demonstrate that things work properly for the n equals 1 theory. And in fact, there's little doubt that this will work for any cut constructible one loop amplitude. Okay, and then we just heard about the holomorphic anomaly, which is really very beautiful. So the Brandhuber et al. Result shows that there must be a much simpler twister space interpretation of the loop amplitudes than had previously been understood. Things were very confused, and I can say we wasted an awful lot of computer power trying to understand twister space properties of loop amplitudes without the holomorphic anomaly, and I can tell you it makes no sense. So with the observation of this holomorphic anomaly, then things become much clearer. So Witten introduced this collinearity operator. So if you want to know in twister space, these are points in twister space. If they lie in a line, the condition is that this epsilon product with those points is equal to zero. When you do the Fourier transform back into momentum space, into ordinary amplitudes of momentum space, what happens is you then find a differential operator. So an algebraic condition in twister space turns into a differential equation back in coordinate space, because it's no big deal or no surprise, it's just a Fourier transform. And the holomorphic anomaly, as Freddie said, is a fancy name for something very simple. It's something we all know. And in fact, this comment about delta functions existing with these operators was in Witten's original paper, but the significance was not understood. But Cacciazzo, Svercek, and Witten clarified that and pointed out that the existence of this holomorphic anomaly. The anomaly means that if you take a derivative of a positive helicity with negative helicity or vice versa, these are not independent variables at the point where this function is not analytic. This 1 over z is not analytic at z equals 0, so then you get a delta function. And they wrote down this delta function, complete analogy with this formula. Then the observation, a very neat observation, is that these delta functions are sufficient to fix the cuts, that if you evaluate the phase space integral of this anomaly with these delta functions, then the phase space integral is trivial. It's just a set of, it becomes algebraic. The delta function fixes all phase space integrals, and you get some very simple conditions. In fact, you can read the conditions off of here. This delta function implies that these two guys have to be collinear in order for this spinner inner product to vanish. I mean, collinear in momentum space. So the momenta of these two spinners have to be collinear. That's this claim over here, this statement here. The L2 is on shell, so that you get a L squared equals zero, so you get another condition from that. And then you just substitute that back into the phase space integral. There's a Jacobian, but the Jacobian is quite simple to work out. So we wrote a paper, and then the very next day, on commenting about phase space, the very next day, Freddie had a paper out, and then went a lot further than us. What he showed, as he already explained, is this very powerful way to get the coefficients of these box integrals. The basic idea is that you apply, let's say, one of these collinear operators to the cut of an amplitude. And on the left-hand side, this is something you can integrate because it's just some delta functions. It's trivial to integrate. On the right-hand side, then the idea is that you can, since you know what the basis of box functions are, you can apply F to it. And in fact, Freddie went on to show that these coefficients must be annihilated by these collinear operators, these twister space collinear operators. Otherwise, you'd find a logarithm on this side of the equation, but you can't have a logarithm on the other side of the equation because you just integrated some delta functions. And in fact, this gives a very powerful way to evaluate these coefficients. And I want to congratulate them for finding such a beautiful application of twister space, such a powerful way to do these to do these calculations of the coefficients using twister space. And for if you move away from these are next to MHV that I'm talking about. So this is 3 minus helicities, this property here, the next to MHV. So that's 3 minuses. Then you get these algebraic equations. If you look at the n equals 1 super Yang-Mills case as a step towards QCD, what you find instead that you get some differential instead of algebraic equations, which was explained in this paper. So using this holomorphic anomaly, then Cacciazzo and his collaborators then worked out an algebraic method for determining the coefficients, and they worked out this amplitude here, 3 minuses and 4 pluses. And just a few days later, we posted our results for all the remaining seven point amplitudes. So this is one helicity configuration, and then a few days later, we had the rest of them posted. You might be amused to know that this is equivalent to doing 227,585 diagrams. And in fact, if you were to pick the heptagon diagram, then no one would actually know how to do that. So I'm just saying there's one diagram in there that no one would actually even know how to do. But of course, the key idea is the simplicity of the tree amplitudes feeds into the simplicity of the loop amplitudes. So these box functions, these BIs, these are box functions, scalar box functions. These are known. It's just a set of functions in terms of polylogarithms. So in our paper, we list all the coefficients. It's just one example. So this would be for minuses arranged in this order. And then here's one of these coefficients. The puzzle of exactly why there are these denominators here, this actually puzzled me for many years, and I kept on saying there must be a reason for it. Well, I'm happy to say there now is a reason, and the reason can be explained through the holomorphic anomaly very easily, why this structure appears here. So the key result from our paper was, the key idea was to try to understand the twister space structure of the loop amplitudes. And it turns out that there is, in fact, a very beautiful structure. And not surprisingly, because as I said, properties of tree amplitudes feed into properties of loop amplitudes. So the terms in the integral function coefficients, so some coefficients can be a sum of terms, but if you pick one term, then in twister space, what you discover is that all the points will lie on a triangle, and these three intersecting straight lines in twister space. One point will be at one of the intersections, and on top of that, all of this lives in a plane. And in fact, just last week, two proofs of this coplanarity appeared. It's based on these ideas about how tree level feeds into loop level, and this is what Freddie used in his proof. It's really based on the same discussion that Freddie had for showing that these coefficients, that the coefficients get annihilated by these collinear operators. It's just a matter of then applying the same ideas to prove that this is coplanar. But the existence of such structure really points that there are more of them. This is just the beginning. This is just an NMHV next to MHV. There's a lot more amplitudes out there. And surely the full understanding of the twister space structure is going to lead to further computational advances. Okay, so in my remaining time, I want to talk about higher loops. So that takes care of one loop. Let's talk about higher loops. So let's talk about four-point. As I said, as the number of loops goes up, the computations get more complicated. So at higher loops, the place we have the hard evidence is at 4 points. So here's the one loop 4-point amplitude. It's a very simple function. So these are 4 massless points in this box integral. It's a very simple function. At 2 loops, it turns out that by using the unitarity technique, you can show that the integrand is given in terms of the scalar box integral. So this is n equals 4 super Yang mils at 4 points. These objects, they are known, but they are rather complicated. They're in terms of fourth order polylogarithms. But we know exactly what they are, so then it's a question of what properties can we learn. So there's some story associated with why we decided to look for this. That has to do with calculations with splitting amplitudes. But anyway, once you know what you're looking for, it's very easy to prove it, because we know all the functions that appear, and you can demonstrate the following formula, that the 4.2 loop amplitude, that's the planar part of it, is given in terms of the one loop amplitude. It's the one loop amplitude divided by the tree squared, plus linear, and then plus there's a constant here. And what this shows is an example of that statement that Freddie made, that the higher loop amplitudes are not really much more complicated than the one loop in terms of their analytic structure. And I should say, it's actually a little non-trivial to prove this. If you were to look at the functional form of this and the functional form of that, you would discover they're rather different, but there's a variety of polylogarithm and also these generalized Nielsen identities that you need to use, these Nielsen functions, a type of generalized polylogarithm. And once you use the identities and go to a basis of functions, then in fact you can prove this. What about the generalization to endpoints? Well, we don't know how to compute endpoints. 4 points, two loops is state of the art. No one can do better. But we do have tools. There's always a trick. And the trick is the collinear behavior. True, we can't compute, let's say, 5 or 10 points or two loops. But we have trickery, and the trickery is from the collinear behavior. We understand a lot about the analytic structure of amplitudes, S matrix elements, have a very definite structure. Every pole must correspond to a particle propagating. The splitting functions have a very definite universal behavior. Well, we've calculated this, the two-loop splitting amplitude that was in this paper, and this paper then told us what behavior we should expect, and then you can write down an ansatz immediately based on that, the structure of the two-loop amplitudes, as well as the structure of the four-point amplitude. And the ansatz is exactly what I wrote down before, except I put an N here instead of a 4, and this general structure seems to hold. I should say there's infrared divergences, which might be confusing, but anyway, the important part is the finite remainder after you subtract the infrared divergences. Now, I should say that this conjecture is almost certainly true for MHV amplitudes. I would be shocked if it wasn't true, but it's much less clear for non-MHV. It very well may not be true. But as we know from Freddie's talk, that non-MHV is related to MHV. So the key is to show that this conjecture is true. There is no technology available from doing this directly by any kind of integration. The integration rules are simply not known for n greater than 4 in terms of being able to carry it out. There's an algorithm for doing it, but it would be one heck of a calculation. Okay. And we want to do it endpoint here. So clearly, twister space is the right way to think about this. Now, if you look at that structure two loops 4 points, well, then you might as well be bold and say, well, look, this general structure must continue forever, because we're physicists, we have a proof. You know, it works for two loops, and well, okay, therefore it must work forever. Well, okay, we need to do better than that. The three-loop computation, by the way, is certainly possible. Smirnov has worked out one of the integrals that's needed, and he's well on his way to work out the second integral that's needed. So, in fact, we will do the three-loop sooner or later by just integrating it. But it would be nice to do this, to try to understand the structure from the twister space, to try to show what this general structure is. So in fact, as you notice, as I go up in loops, the conjecture gets vaguer, right? Because you see, I didn't even write down precisely what this is. And the reason is because there's some functions in there. So if you go back, here it is. You go back, there's certain functions that appear in here, which They're hard to predict ahead of time. Okay, but this is the structure that we're looking for as we go to higher loops, and we want to think about twister space. So here's a list of key issues for the future. So those recursion relations, I think it would be really neat if we could solve them explicitly. So the CSW rules, they give you any amplitude you want. You know, for fixed n, you can sit down and you can crank away and you can get the answer. What I mean here is one solution, which is you have the answer before you calculate. So it's a solution, a complete solution to the recursion relation. I think that would be possible and very interesting to do. At one loop, the key question, call it the holy grail of one loop, is applications to QCD. And the key difficulty for QCD is you cannot just march ahead using what's already known. You need some new ideas. And the problem has to do with this distinction between four dimensions in the cuts and d dimensions in the cuts. In dimensional regularization, unless you have some special theorems to back you up, you must be in d dimensions. As soon as you are in d dimensions, you can kiss the twisters goodbye. Okay? Because they live in four dimensions. But there is going to be a trick for doing this. That I am very optimistic for. But this is the key question, how to apply these ideas to QCD calculations, not just supersymmetric calculations. At multi-loops, the question is, in twister space, can we use the twister space ideas to prove this iteration of the S matrix? And if you have the iteration of the S matrix, you can even start talking about resummation with a straight face. Right now, we can't talk about resummation because we don't know. Right, it's just a conjecture, and it, as you saw, as you go up in loop order, it's a vague conjecture. In string theory, the obvious and important question is to really find a string theory dual, an honest string theory dual to these loop amplitudes, where the conformal supergravity has been projected out, as there'll be discussion a little bit later today. The topological B model is polluted with conformal gravity. And if you know anything about conformal gravity, you know that this is really pollution. Okay, so the summary is, first the motivation. The LHC is on the horizon. The Tevatron is working away. These experiments demand QCD loop calculations to make real progress, a breakthrough, so that it's not just one more little tiny epsilon more calculation. To really try to grab a hold of the problem and solve it, you need new tricks. Twister space is clearly the most promising trick on the horizon that you can see that will solve these problems. Then there's the question of, can we solve n equals 4 super Yang-Mills theory? I'm talking about the S matrix here. Can we write down the entire S matrix in some way? So one of the more specialized topics I discuss is the sufficient recursive reformulation of the CSW diagrams, turning this exponential growth in the number of negative helicities to polynomial growth. So that makes it an efficient way to do very high multiplicities, to numerically evaluate very high multiplicities, as one might need for applications to phenomenology. The basic tool is these generalized unitarity cuts. The idea is we can obtain any loop amplitude from tree amplitudes using an on-shell formulation. You do not need any kind of off-shell construction to generate S matrix elements. All the properties of loop amplitudes from this viewpoint are inherited from the tree amplitudes. If you know some property of the tree amplitude, for example, you know that they're extremely simple and described by Park-Taylor amplitudes, that will then turn into properties of the loop amplitudes. Or you know something about twister space, tree amplitudes, that then turns into properties of loop amplitudes. So it's a very general concept that you can apply to any idea and any notion that you have about tree amplitudes. There are these very important and powerful new tools that Freddy discussed, the holomorphic anomaly. It clarifies what's going on at one loop, and even more importantly and impressively, it allows you to calculate. And I discussed this calculation of all the one-loop helicity amplitudes using this direct unitarity method, and it has a very the result is that we find a very intriguing twister space structure. And then the last topic was that I presented non-trivial evidence that the N equals 4 super Yang Mills S matrix iterates to all loop orders. And finally, it's clear that there are a variety of exciting avenues for further exploration.
Okay, so thank you. Okay. Okay.
It is my impression that the tree-level amplitudes and the loop amplitudes all use planar diagrams to some extent. Is there some notion of non-planarity?
Did you say one loop?
Yeah, one loop and,
no,
and,
one
and
loop,
the
okay,
tree
at
level.
One loop, okay. At tree level, it's trivial because everything is planar. At one loop, you can prove that anything that's non-planar or a subleading color is directly obtainable from leading color. So that means that you don't have to worry about subleading color, because once you've worked out the leading color, meaning the planar, if you wish, then you know everything about the entire S matrix. As you go to higher loops, now you go to two loops, then that's no longer true, because you find now honest non-planar topologies which have a completely different analytic structure. Okay. Now the claim of solving the N equals 4, almost certainly this is going to be planar. It's very unlikely, I think, that one will be able to find a solution non-planar. If we look at the two-loop amplitudes, I showed you that beautiful iteration in terms of one loop. That's for the planar. If you look at the non-planar, the only thing you discover is that you have no idea there's nothing you can see as far as we can tell.
So what's the most urgent computation that remains to be done for the LHC application?
Just a general technology. The most pressing problems are not actually the pure QCD ones. At loop level, you need masses with vector bosons or Higgs. That's clearly the most important problems, but one thing at a time. Right, first, we're going to solve the massless case. And if you have a technology that beats to death very efficiently and effectively one-loop pure QCD calculations with massless quarks, you are doing extremely well.
I have a similar comment or question about the application of all of this formalism to LHC. What is going on that the understanding of this of the QCD correction, basically, of this higher level, even tree diagrams, is rudimentary in the moment. It's rudimentary. It's really not very good. For example, in the small X region, they are all type of resummations, and they do not lead to very clear results. You see, they may change, results.
Now, considerably. This was not a talk about QCD applications to colliders. In certain kinematic regions, one must do resummation, and there is no way that a fixed order calculation is sufficient. However, there are kinematic regions where you must do these fixed order calculations in order to have control over the uncertainty. The tree level is definitely not sufficient. Next to leading order, in many cases, even that's not sufficient. But let's not be greedy. Let's solve the next to leading order.
Okay. You mentioned this relation between the S matrix and anomalous dimensions.
Yes.
Is that may be practical? So, given an operator, you can tell me which amplitudes need to be computed.
Well, the relationship was for, in a sense, pieces of the amplitudes. Well, let's see if I can find it. It's not really for, it's not, okay. So the thing I showed you is very specialized. It's just a very special set of operators. It's these leading twist operators. It wasn't even a relationship between amplitudes and anomalous dimensions. It was a relationship between the splitting amplitudes, so in other words, the behavior of the amplitudes, and these anomalous dimensions. But what's important about this is it shows that such relationships exist, and I am sure that this is just one example of relationships, and I think that's a very interesting question about finding a much more general mapping. One could imagine, well, for example, instead of looking at the splitting, this 1-2 splitting, you're looking at 1-3 splitting, and you relate that to a set of operators, and I'm sure that there's some way of doing this.
You mentioned the problem of QCD and the cut structure being incompatible with dimensional regularization, or the problems
in four dimensions. Well, if you're trying to do helicity on the cuts,
right,
you run into a little bit of a problem.
So why not use other methods of regularizing QCD?
Ah, that's a very good question. The problem isn't the regularization. The problem is the answer is wrong. So if you were to start with a four-dimensional expression using helicity, and you want to then extract the QCD loop from that, you can regularize this way, you can regularize that way, but you started with wrong expressions. So
it's not just the continuation. And
no. Let's say you were doing a massive regularization, then you would need to know amplitudes with masses in them, not massless ones. So it's just a different, the structure of those amplitudes, less is known than the structure of... The continuation to D dimensions and masses are closely related. So these are different sides of the same coin.
This two-loop result was an iteration of one loop, right?
Mm-hmm.
And, at two loops, I mean, this box diagram, it obviously contains two-loop Dglap, right? Splitting function. If I do OPE on the two ends, then I'll have a Dglap splitting function to two-loop there. And your result presumably implies that you have two loops. I mean, it's somehow it's a product or convolution or something.
Your statement isn't quite right. That two-loop, that would not give you the full Dglap. There's pieces missing, but I accept there's a relationship.
No, I mean, it's amazing what you see is that you have a factorization. I mean, we know if we'll take, known Dglap splitting functions in n equals 4, you know it's not the case, right? So therefore, there is something I don't
know. No. That statement isn't true. If we take a certain piece of the Dglap splitting function, then in fact the piece I'm talking about is a virtual correction. You know, we should discuss this afterwards. Okay. Let's discuss it afterwards.
Yeah, because there are other harmonic numbers there.
Yeah, there is.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, I'd like to comment a little bit about some analogies that when you're talking about factorization of higher loops, kind of immediate analogy which comes to mind, it's like n equal 1 supersymmetric theory when you're considering gauge coupling, which contains all the loops, but higher loops are factorizable.
The
higher loops, mm-hmm, it's only due to holomorphic anomaly.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, it might be superficial analogy, but it is still kind of
okay.
Thank you, and we have a coffee break now.